Hello and welcome back to The Late Set. This is Nate Chenin. And today we have a little something from The Vault featuring saxophonist, composer, bandleader Gary Bartz. He is the subject of this week's episode of The Late Set Radio Hour, which is broadcasting at WRTI 90.1 FM in the Philadelphia area, and of course on WRTI.org worldwide and on the WRTI app. Now, the Late Set Radio Hour features a ton of music. We really pack it in. So you will hear material from across Gary Bartz's career. In this podcast version, the OG version of the Late Set, we're focusing on the interview. And this is a conversation we had early in 2024 on site at the Winter Jazz Fest. He was performing on a concert called A Night at the East at the Crown Hill Theater in Brooklyn. And Greg Bryant, my friend and then co-host, sat down with Mr. Bartz upstairs during the sound check for the concert. In fact, if you listen closely, you may hear the band warming up downstairs as we are doing this interview. I know I can speak for Greg because we talked about it later, but the two of us felt extremely fortunate to be sharing space with Gary Bartz. And he was really generous with his wisdom, his insights, his presence, his spirit. This was a really beautiful conversation. Part of it touches on the fact that he had just recently been named an NEA Jazz Master, a designation that he had a certain amount of ambivalence about. As we're talking now in the fall of 2025, kind of seems like the NEA Jazz Masters program is a thing of the past. So I am grateful, at least, that we managed to get one in the hands of Gary Bartz while the getting was good. So this conversation, once again, was a real honor for us. We consider it a highlight of this show. I hope you enjoy it, whether for the first or second time. Here we are with Gary Bartz.
The inimitable Gary Bartz. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's so awesome to see you. Right now, we're in the Crown Hill Theater in Brooklyn. This was very close to a place that we're going to tribute tonight. Can you tell us a little bit about the East?
Well, the East was really a very special place for the community to experience music that wasn't necessarily being heard in other places, and for sure not the way it was presented at the East. So it was very special. It was a part of the Uhuru Sasa school that G2 Weyusi started, and he felt that they needed a cultural, because they were definitely into the music, and so they started this club. You know, this venue. I wouldn't even call it a club. It was more like a church. It was more like a spiritual gathering. And most of the musicians there that they would bring in, and they brought all kinds of musicians in, but it was especially for the so-called black community. And so that's where they put the emphasis.
Right. You're already helping me to understand and what you said right there, you know, spirit-centered, musician-centered, and you're no stranger to that. Your father was a proprietor of music in Baltimore.
He was.
Tell me a little bit about that, and growing up in a scene that was more nurturing and inclusive of music lovers and musicians as the presenter.
Well, he bought the club. I had already moved to New York City.
Okay.
I moved to New York here in 1958. He bought the nightclub in 1960. So, you know, I started commuting from New York down to Baltimore on the weekends, you know, and come back to New York during the week. So, the club became successful enough that I worked there with Max Roach. Actually, when I joined Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, they were doing a week at my dad's club called the North End Lounge. And John Gilmore was in the band. And my dad found out that John Gilmore was getting ready to leave. And so he called me in New York. He said, you might want to come down and sit in with Art, you know, because it looks like his saxophone player is getting ready to leave. And John Hicks was in the band. John was a good friend of mine. He was trying to get me in the band anyway. And Lee Morgan also. So Lee Morgan was the straw boss in the band. He was the, you know, he made all the, he was the music director, I guess you could say. So I came down and sat in with him, and Art and Lee co-signed it. So I actually joined the band right there. You know, wow. In my dad's club. First gig was Boston. We did 2 weeks up at Paul's Mall in Boston. But yeah, so.
That's awesome.
You know, when I think about all these affiliations that you've had, mm-hmm. There are very few people I can name who spent time with more legendary band leaders. Mm-hmm. So I wondered, in thinking about Art Blakey and Max Roach and Miles Davis and Charles Mingus, and I could keep going, is there a particular band leader whose approach to fostering unity in the band really spoke to you? Like, who do you look to as the gold star in that sense?
Well, I look to all of them because I learned something from each one. I mean, really learned stuff from each one. So, you know, it's a study in, you know, like you have old style band leaders, you have band leaders who have their own style, you know, but with Art, I learned what not to do.
Really?
I learned a lot of what not to do. With Max, I learned what to do as far as business, as far as things like that. With Miles, I learned that, I mean, Miles was such a listener that if you were in his band, you were in his family. And so that was different from the other band leaders. I mean, it was always a family thing, but really, I mean, like, you couldn't do much if you were in this band. That, for example, Red Garland's one time didn't show up for a gig in Philadelphia for 3 nights.
Okay.
So, you know, he had to get a sub for the, you know, Miles had to find a sub, you
yeah.
know, when Red came, they were happy. Okay, we got him back, you know, so that's family, you know, but that wouldn't happen with Max. Mm-hmm. You mm-hmm. If you were late, he had a problem with me being late, you know, so each one is different.
If you were to compare your own approach to any one of those mm-hmm. masters, who are you most like as a band leader?
Well, I think it's a little bit of all of them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah. Because I take a little bit there, and, you know, I like the family thing with Miles, you know. I like the way Max presented. You know, one thing he would always say, no music on the bandstand. That, I mean, he was really a stickler about that, you know, and I am too. He passed that on to me, but I understand why. There are many reasons why you don't have music. For one, it's a rehearsal. If you're reading, mm-hmm. you know, and my thing is like, I don't want to go to the theater and see the actors reading from the script.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what that is. You know, if you can't take the time to remember what you got to do, mm-hmm. don't, you know, you're not ready.
When I think about folks on the scene now, like Logan Richardson or Emmanuel Wilkins and even Kenny Garrett, you are the link. I think that you are really responsible for the now sound of alto saxophone. And when Nate mentioned Art Blakey and Max Roach, I'm thinking in my mind, Gary had to project to get over that power. Mm-hmm. There's an urgency in your sound that I hear mm-hmm. from the 60s to the early 70s to now that I feel like is the way to play the alto saxophone. Mm-hmm. What wisdom would you impart maybe to a young person that you find talented that's trying to get their thing together? Can you give us some gems or jewels on the Gary Bartz ethos to projecting and making your sound count?
When students ask me, you know, they'll come, they'll say, I don't like my sound. You know, I say, I'm working on my sound. And so my first question is, well, what do you want to sound like? What is your vision of your sound? And that's the first thing. You know, you want to find, well, what do you want to sound like? So a lot of guys that don't know what they want to sound like, but they want to play the saxophone or they want to play an instrument, they let the sound find them. And so they end up with, just a sound. It's still a sound, you know. But what we were trying to, what many musicians do, we have a vision of what we want to sound like. And so then we have something to go towards. We have something to work towards to develop that sound. I know Pharoah Sanders and I, because I, you know, I always wanted a bigger sound. Pharoah and I would go out to the park, you know, West Side Highway, and just play loud, because you can play loud outdoors, you know. And no matter how loud you play in the house, you always don't want to play as loud as you can play, you know, because you wouldn't be living there long. So, but we would go out there and we would try to play so loud that we were looking over and you see the cars going up and down the West Side Highway. We would try to play so loud to make some, you know, make somebody say, what was that? You know, of course that never happened. You know, that's not going to happen. But that's how loud we were trying to play. So we were trying to develop that sound, you know. So, you know, you have to know what you want to sound like.
And as a follow-up to that, I also noticed when you mentioned, you know, practicing with Pharoah, Into the Wind, you know, there's no harmonic underpinning. It's just you're responsible for your rhythm and for your melody. How much of that ethos or idea factors into you building the Into Troupe band in the early 70s?
Well, what I wanted was a band that could play anywhere. That's why we didn't have a piano, because you can't take a piano in the jungle. You know, you can't take a piano into the bush. So I wanted instruments that we can go anywhere and play. So that was the first thing, you know. And the second thing is, and I've had people, you know, I remember one gentleman in, I think it was in Germany, he said, you know, those Into Troupe records, I really didn't understand. I really didn't like it so much. And I said, well, I wasn't writing it for you. I wasn't, you know, I was writing it for my community. And I hope everybody likes it, you know, but if they don't, I understand, because I wasn't really addressing this to you, you know. But if you were astute enough, you could understand what I'm trying to say, you know. So, you know, he had a problem.
We must get closer to the end of life, but be aware that it takes courage and strife.
I do think about audience in that time frame, because when I first saw footage of you on stage with Miles at the Isle of Wight Festival, it kind of blew my mind, because I knew the music, you know, I understood that this was a moment where this music was reaching, you know, young audiences and big audiences. But until you see that camera sweep across that sea of people, you know. But it's funny, because at the same time, like, who is in that audience, and what does it mean to them? Is it like, is it just cool in that moment? Is it part of like a vogue, or does it really like connect on a spiritual level? And I feel like as an artist, sometimes those distinctions don't really register, and sometimes they're screaming at you, you know. And so when I think about those records, it always rings to me of this very foregrounded desire to resonate in the community, you know, and to be at street level. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like what hip hop is, and because it comes from the street. It's a folk music. It started with the blues. It started way before that. But there are different ways of communicating. You know, like for me, when I don't call set lists, you know, because I don't know the audience yet, you know, so I don't want to be so bold to think I know what everybody, you know, so I kind of try to feel the audience. And so when I'm, you know, so as I'm playing, I'm feeling the audience, I'm hearing them, you know, and I'm seeing what hearing what the reactions are. So then that depends. And also the way the music is going depends on what the next song is going to be, you know. But as far as the Two Troop is concerned, like, because that's this was in the 60s. This was the 60s was a very volatile period. I mean, we got all our leaders were killed. You know, President of the United States was killed in public. In public. That's the hardest place to kill somebody. You know,
yeah,
but they got away with it. You know, they got, I mean, all these people, and they got away with it. Come on, man. But that's a whole nother story. But so I was really thinking about joining something like the Black Panthers, because I felt like our community did not need, we got enough musicians, because almost all of us can do something, you know, musically, because music to me is nature's religion. It's not a man-made religion. It comes straight from nature. Sufis say that the Big Bang happened because whatever the mass was, when it reached the note that it was in tune with, it made it explode, the way Ella Fitzgerald can sing a note that whatever the glass is in tune and make it explode. So, and I believe this, so music is our religion. So but at that time I didn't realize that, you know, so I'm thinking about the Black Panthers, but through my interactions and working with and being around Max Roach, Charlie Mingus, and different Donald Byrd and Gigi Grice, you know, who were thinking differently, you know, and that made me say, well, oh, music can be powerful. It can be. I don't need to join the Black Panthers to do what they were doing. Music can also do that, and that's what I do, so let me try to do that with the music. So that's how the Two Troop really came about.
It's had an impact on me for sure. I still play those records frequently.
Tell me, people tell me, like, they say, man, I got through the Vietnam War listening to that, you know, listening to the little old man rocking, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's what we were trying to do, you know.
Yeah, I think about right around that time, too, we were talking off mic about the Umoja Ensemble from Entombe recorded at the East. And I just look at the lineup. My goodness, you and bassist Buster Williams and drummer Billy Hart. I don't want to call all the names, but you get my point. This is a powerhouse ensemble. And I think about today and the collaborative spirit. So many challenges. We've always had economic challenges, but there's something about coming together on one accord with one mission, with one mind. You know how Coltrane was saying he wanted to be a force for good?
Yeah.
He really felt that beyond the music, he could change the core of a
and
person's.
You can. You can. Not just music, but it can be done. But, I mean, who wants to go through life doing that, trying to teach somebody else, you know, how to be a human being? That's something that your parents need to teach you. You know, but you know, when the occasion arises, you can then do that. So that's what I was trying to do with the music. That's just like he was, you know. I mean, I'm influenced by him. I mean, I met these guys. I met Sonny Stitt. I met Max Rhodes. I sat in with Sonny Stitt when I was 14.
Oh my goodness!
I sat in with Max.
And lived to tell the tale.
Oh, well, he was, you know, I didn't try to sit in with him. I found out that he was doing a matinee in this club in Baltimore called the Comedy Club. And so I asked my dad if he would take me. So he said, sure. So we go down there, place is packed. You know, it's the afternoon, kids are there and everything. And so Sonny's playing, man, he gets on the mic. He says, well, ladies and gentlemen, I understand we have a gentleman, you know, a young man that'd like to come up and play with us. And I'm saying, oh, man, this is going to be good. I want to see. And he called my name.
Wow.
And I said, oh, my Lord, man. My dad had sneaked his horn, sneaked my horn out, and went up and told him he would like to, you know, which I didn't want to go up. But I went up there, and he took me, being the nice gentleman Sonny Stitt was. He took me through all the keys on the blues.
Wow.
So fortunately, I didn't know one key from the other. They were all the same to me because I, you know, at that point, I'm all ears, you know. So I went through every key, you know. So he said, well, okay, I think he's got potential.
That's great.
And so then I sat in with Max, and Max, same thing. He took me, he said, Cherokee. It's just, you know, I started because of Charlie Parker. I knew everything Bird did. So I went through it. Didn't know the chords, but I could hear the chords. Mm-hmm. I could hear it. I didn't play the wrong notes. Mm-hmm. I was hear the chords. Mm-hmm. That's why I say listening is more important than playing, because I listened so hard I could hear what notes were right, what notes were wrong. And so I didn't play them, you know, on purpose anyway. So, you know, he gave me his number, and that's how we connected when I moved up to New York, you know. I met Train when I was 14. I met Train and Benny Golson. They were working, I think, with Earl Bostic or somebody, and they were supposed to do 2 weeks in Baltimore. The second week I canceled, so they were just hanging around, and they came to a jam session I was at, and that's how I met them. And I didn't know who they were, and I didn't realize it until Benny Golson, many years later, said, yeah, you remember when me and John met? I said, when? You know, I said, that was y'all. but listening is the most important thing, you know.
There's something really crucial in what you were just saying, you know, the pure receptivity that you had as a young person, and as you say, all ears, but also your musical erudition was intact, but it was unschooled. It was self-developed, and there's been a shift, you know, in the culture of this music where the instruction is, you know, it can be pretty formalized. It can even be really rigid. And most of the musicians who I hear and respond to have found a way either to integrate that into their humanity or to kind of absorb it and then reject it, you know? And so, as someone who has been teaching for a really long time within institutions like Oberlin, what are your thoughts about how the music has been sort of institutionalized and how that transmission of information has come out of the communities, you know, in many cases and been put, you know,
corrupted.
Yeah. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Because it's being taught by a group of people who it's not their music. So that's why Dr. Logan started the program at Oberlin, because he realized it's being taught by non-musicians, really. You know, I mean, they can't go out and do what they're talking about, you know. So he wanted musicians who were still doing this, you know, and that was the whole thing. Because that's how we learned it, from the musicians that came before us. You know, I mean, it was passed on to them, you know, to us from them. And that's the way it is. Griot, we are a griot culture. You know, they say, well, they didn't write books. No, we had historians. That's part of our culture. So that's what the music is. And so, but we were always looking for our own sound. We did not want to sound like anybody else, you know, because there's no money in that, you know. I mean, I've had times where I've gone to record dates and they say, well, we want you to sound like Grover Washington on this cut. Hmm. And I said, well, get Grover Washington.
Sure.
You know, because sure. So, but that's the way they think, they kind of think, you know. But we were always looking for our own individual sound. And if you're looking for that, you have to hear the future. And that's why Miles was so important, because he always heard the future, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Playing, I mean, we hear the future all the time in playing, you mm-hmm. know, you know, if we're listening, but you have to be listening. You can't be just hearing it. You have to be listening. It's a whole nother thing from hearing, you know. But that's why I say listening is more important than playing. Mm-hmm. It really is. It's the most important thing, because you can have a band of, say, it's a quintet. Three of the musicians are listening to everything. Two are not. They're listening to themselves, or they're thinking about, you know, some girl in the audience. It's not going to work. Mm. All five have to be listening together, just like a basketball team or any great team. Everybody has to be on the same page. Mm. And that's why the greatest bands in this music and the innovative bands have come through a working band that was together for at least 2 years. It takes about 2 years. And then you can really, you know, start to do things that nobody ever heard before, you know, because the musicians are reaching, they're trying to do things that they see. For me, the job of an artist musician, because we're not just musicians, we're you know, you have musicians who, they're musicians. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Play on Broadway, do weddings, they do circus, you know, whatever. But we, for us, we're artists that music is our medium. So it there's different meanings to it. We're not, it's not just about entertainment necessarily, you know, it's about more than that. So that's why the listening, so only if you can hear, and I think hearing is like a fingerprint, so everybody hears different. If you can find out how you hear, nobody can sound like that. Nobody can hear like you. That's why you got to be able to hear, you know, and you can only do that by listening, and you got to hear that. But, you know, I say now, you know, when I meditate now, I hit one of my bells, one of my singing bowls. I hit it, and you hear it ring, and then you hear, and it disappears. I say, that's where I want to go. where it disappears to, that's where you have to find out where what you hear, you know?
Man, that's really powerful.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate how, like Max Roach before you and Miles Davis, you rejected the term jazz early on. And as a listener, I think I'm amazed at how that allowed you to just genre weave. I'll just call it that. You could do swing one day. You could do a backbeat one day. Odd meter. Completely free. There was no limit. And I feel like a lot of people our age and even younger have resonated with you because your catalog is so vast. It's got a little bit of everything. You can pick what you like or like it all. I'm really curious with this new designation, and congratulations with your NEA designation. You probably should have won it 10 years ago, but there's so many peers that you're now with this designation. But the word is still there, and I just wanted to get your thoughts. Are you conflicted about it or at all? I don't want to get you in trouble, but I'm just curious, like, how do you feel about being designated an NEA jazz master?
Well, I just say NEA master, you know, so. Mm-hmm.
There it is.
Thank you.
NEA, call it what you want, master.
Yeah, right. Well, they call us what they want anyway, you know, so that's a whole nother thing. All
right. But congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that, you know, Greg touched on this, but the fact that so much of your cohort, and these are like your brothers, you know, think about Jabali, Billy Hart, and we think about Buster Williams. I mean, these are recent inductees to this society. It has to feel really nice to be joining your gang, you know?
Well, it does. I didn't expect it. I didn't think that they would choose me because of my politics, you know, and because of some of the Two Troop records, you know. So I, you know, I was resigned to that. That's okay, you know, but I was pleasantly surprised when they did vote me in.
Yeah.
but you have to realize, and I hope I don't get myself in trouble, but politics has a lot to do with all this stuff. As far as politics has a lot to do with what's number one on the record charts. It has a lot to do, you know, in everything. Politics is involved. Sometimes they choose the right things. Sometimes they don't. You know, they choose things because of the politics. So you're keeping that in mind, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's always a good thing to receive an honor. So I do receive it humbly, you know. Yeah. Even though they want to call it something else that I don't.
Sure.
They don't really know what I'm doing. They're choosing me, but they don't really know what I'm doing, really. Because if they're saying, this is what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep listening and we'll keep learning. Thank you for dropping your jewels with us and trusting us. It's been our pleasure to talk to you, Mr. Bartz, for the late set. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure talking to you guys, too.
So what did I tell you? A great conversation with Gary Bartz. And maybe you also listened to the late set radio hour on the air. It's part of our new Sunday rotation. Either way, we want to hear what you think. Please rate us on your podcast service of choice. Give us those 5 stars if you can. And tell us how we're doing. You can always reach me at editor@wrti.org. Special thanks this episode to the staff at the Crown Hill Theater in Brooklyn, to Bryce Rosenblum and Matt Merowitz with the Winter Jazz Fest, and to all of you for listening and supporting The Late Set. We want to remind you that our next new episode drops on Tuesday. It will feature Josh Jackson's conversation with the brilliant drummer and bandleader and composer Jonathan Blake. And we hope as we are approaching the Thanksgiving holiday that you are surrounded by loved ones and great music. Thanks for letting us be a part of it. Take care.